I hope my endorsement will get you over the top. I think we're going to do pretty well this election. I look around and I see in Kentucky, where I'm from, the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate can't remember who she voted for president. She can't remember the name of who she voted for. Then you come to Iowa, and everybody comes here campaigning for the Democrat, but they can't remember his name either. I really do wish the best to Bruce Bailey, and I hope Bruce does. Bruce Bailey does well. But it is a troubling sign when they don't know his name. You think? Do you think they know what he stands for if they can't remember his name? I think that the wind is behind us because most of the things we look at around the country, most of the things you look at, job opportunities, pay, what you can expect when you get out of college, whether you have a job, whether you don't have a job, you look at whether there's more poverty in our country or less poverty, more unemployment or less unemployment, most of the signals seem to be worse under this president. The Democrats are talking about income inequality. Well, it's worse under this president than the last president. It's worse in cities run by Democrat mayors, worse in states run by Democrats. So if they're complaining about income inequality, maybe they're talking that we need a change. Maybe we do need a change in our country. The bottom line is that I'm concerned. I'm concerned for your freedom, not only your economic liberty, but your personal liberty. There are two arguments for why I think we should try to keep government minimal, why we should try to keep federal government small. One argument I call the liberty argument. The liberty argument is what Thomas Paine talked about. Thomas Paine wrote around the time of our revolution, and he said that government is a necessary evil. You say, well, what did he mean by that? A necessary evil? It sounds pretty harsh, particularly since I'm part of the government now. But government is a necessary evil, and the reason he wrote that is he said you have to give up part of your freedom. You give up part of your labor. When you work and you get your pay and you pay taxes, your taxes are, when you pay them, it's giving up some of your freedom. Now, this isn't an argument against not paying any taxes or for no government, but it's an argument that if you're giving up part of your labor, if you're giving up part of your freedom, you'd want to give up the least amount that is necessary in order to have a government. So when we wrote our Constitution, we wrote a Constitution that said government should do certain things. The Constitution only allows for about 17, 19 powers, depending on how you count them up. These were the things given to government. Then the Ninth and Tenth Amendment says those powers not granted to the government are left to the states and to the people respectively. We've gotten away from that. We've gotten to where we ignore that. And government pretty much is doing whatever they want. In fact, I ask school kids when they come to Washington, are we a republic or a democracy? To see if they know the difference. You'll hear your politicians often saying, oh, we're for democracy. Well, we're not a democracy. We're a republic. There's a difference. We're a constitutional republic. And people say, well, why didn't the Arab Spring work over there? Well, maybe because they didn't start out with some of the foundations that we started with. We started with some rules. Democracy can't do anything. And I tell people who say, oh, I'm for democracy. I don't care much about republic. Well, that means 51% of the people can enslave 49% of the people. That's one of the problems with a democracy. With our republic and with our Bill of Rights, we had this foundation of certain rights that couldn't be taken away from you. The First Amendment, you know, you should be free to establish your church. You should be free to exercise your religious freedom, but government shouldn't be involved. And the First Amendment has nothing to do with preventing religious people from being involved in government. It's to keep government out of religion. Has anybody seen what they're doing in Houston? The mayor of Houston has sent out a subpoena, and she says to ministers, she wants to see their sermons. Can you imagine in America submitting your sermons to the leaders of government? I can't imagine anything American about that. In fact, when I was thinking about it, I was imagining Martin Luther. Remember Martin Luther in the 1500s nailing to the castle church at Wittenberg and saying he had these objections, these complaints, and it's like, that's what we ought to have now is a modern-day Martin Luther nailing the First Amendment to City Hall in Houston to let them know that we will not sacrifice our religious freedom on an altar of political correctness. Many Republicans are for the Second Amendment, and rightly so, but I say, look, we need to be for the whole Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, and really the Fourth Amendment. The amendment that is most under attack right now is your right to privacy. And people will say, well, there's no right to privacy. The word privacy is not in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't list all of your rights. In fact, some of the people who wrote it in the beginning, they didn't want to have a Bill of Rights because they were afraid if we listed a Bill of Rights, people would think that was all the rights they had. But the Ninth and Tenth Amendments say the power's not given or to be left to the states and the people. It says that the rights are not to be disparaged. The rights aren't all listed. But you do most assuredly have a right to privacy. In the Fourth Amendment, it talks a little bit about your right to privacy. It says a government can't come into your home without a warrant, without your name on a warrant, and without specific probable cause, without a judge's permission, a judge who signs it, who's independent from the police force. An independent judge has to sign a warrant. Why did they do this? Because they were worried. It was one of the reasons we fought the revolution. James Otis, one of our founding fathers, he wrote and he argued and he talked for 2 decades about something called writs of assistance. Writs of assistance were general warrants. Nobody's name was on them. The British soldiers wrote their own warrants, and they were going in anybody's house willy-nilly. And we were very upset about that. In fact, John Adams said this was the spark that got us going. This was the spark that ignited the American Revolution, was our objection to arbitrary authority. But what do you think a warrant is that has Verizon's name on it and that gets every record of everybody who has a phone with Verizon? That's a general warrant. And what I say to people, and I believe this most sincerely, what you say or do on your cell phone is none of the government's damn business. And people say, oh, you must not want to protect the country. You don't want to get terrorists. You can get terrorists. You write down the name of the person suspicious, and you get their records. If they called 100 people, you get another warrant for the people who are suspicious on that list. You go as deep as you need to get the people who would attack our country. I'm a patriot as much as anybody in the country, but what I'm trying to protect is our freedoms. I know a gentleman who lost both legs and an arm in the war, and I asked him what he was fighting for, and he says, I was fighting for the Bill of Rights. You know, if we give it up, what are we fighting for? So we really have to be conscious of what we go to war for. What is it we're protecting? It is our Constitution. We take an oath not to defend democracy. We take an oath to defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. We have to know what we're fighting for. And as we go to war, we have to realize that war isn't always the answer. Even great presidents who believed in a strong national defense, like Ronald Reagan, said war should be the last resort. So we have to look at the history of the Middle East over the last 20 years and say, what's worked, what hasn't worked, what was appropriate and what was inappropriate. I can tell you one thing for sure that I think is true and that it's hard to argue against, that every time we've toppled a secular dictator, chaos has ensued and radical Islam has risen. Are you more or less at risk since Gaddafi's gone? Are you more or less at risk if Assad goes? Are you more or less at risk if Mubarak goes? Are we more or less at risk since Hussein is gone in Iraq? None of these are good people. They're all autocrats and dictators, but they weren't necessarily coming over here to attack us. The people who have replaced all of these leaders have been radical Islamists who would, frankly, come to attack us. So I think we're less safe in this chaos. People say, well, we should have bombed Assad a year ago. If we just bombed Assad, we'd all be safe. If we would have bombed Assad a year ago, ISIS would be in Damascus ruling all of Syria. Our involvement in the Syrian civil war has actually led to the rise of ISIS because they probably wouldn't have been able to organize and grow because they would have been under assault from Assad. Is Assad a great guy? No. There are no good people over there. You ask, well, what about the moderate Syrians? The moderate Syrian rebels are a pit stop. We give them the weapons, they stop there temporarily, and they're taken by ISIS. I said a year ago when I voted against sending arms to the Syrian rebels, I said, the irony that you will not be able to escape is we will be one day back in the Middle East fighting against our own weapons. Does anybody think that maybe we ought to attach a code to turning on our tanks? They've taken these tanks. Wouldn't you think that we are sophisticated enough to somehow have a code to start the tank that would make it hard for them to use our tanks and our Humvees and all of our weapons? Certainly we must be. What? Apparently we're not, but most of the weapons we are now fighting are our own weapons over there. We need to think before we act. But more importantly than anything, we need to obey the Constitution. The Constitution said that no president unilaterally gets to decide. We restricted the power of the president because we didn't like having a king. We split up that power. We separated that power, and we instituted what are called checks and balances. And people ask me, what is the thing that upsets you most about this president? It isn't Obamacare. It isn't Dodd-Frank. It isn't any bill. It's his usurpation of power. It's his abuse of power. It's his overriding of the separation of powers and checks and balances that are the very fabric of our republic. Think about it. One of our founding fathers, or one of the philosophers they looked to, is Montesquieu. And Montesquieu said that when the executive begins to legislate, that that becomes a form of tyranny. There is great worry, and there should be great worry. There can be a lot of opinions over what we do over immigration, but we should all agree that only Congress should do it, that the president shouldn't just do whatever the heck he wants. And think of the consequences. We do things and we say, oh, we're going to have a program of forgiveness, but what happens is then all of Central America wants to come here. Now we have 66,000 kids. We're flying all over the United States at millions of dollars of expenses, and yet nobody really passed the law. We're doing this because the president simply deems it his opinion. The rule of law means obeying the Constitution. We've gotten away from that. I think this election, though, people are going to react because it's been one thing after another. Think of Ebola. The president says he thinks it's okay that you won't catch it riding on the bus with someone with Ebola. I'd like to see a show of hands of those who would like to volunteer to get on a bus with 20 people with Ebola. That's the dumbest statement I've ever heard. And then they say, oh, well, if they're asymptomatic. Well, yeah, if you don't have any symptoms, you're not contagious, okay? But who's going to assure that somebody comes on a 12-hour flight who's not sick when they started, aren't in the process of becoming sick? Who's going to assure that when they fill out a voluntary form that they're going to be honest on their voluntary form? Already we've discovered that they're not. Am I against helping them? No, we could still send supplies to those people in West Africa. We could send supplies, humanitarian aid, but we don't need to have them visiting a cousin or an uncle here for a few months. Could we not reschedule a few meetings of leaders from West Africa for a few months? So the thing is I think it's one thing after another. The president is out of touch with the country. My hope is that you will perceive this, that I will perceive this, the United States will perceive this. We don't get a chance this time to vote on the president, but what I'm hoping for is that if you're unhappy with the president, if you're unhappy with Harry Reid, if you're unhappy with the policies that have been running this country, that you'll give my friend Rod Blum a chance, and I hope we have victory in a week. Thank you very much.